This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. All week, sports writers, columnists, and talk show hosts, as well as callers, have been kicking around the question of whether the New England Patriots should be called a dynasty, should they beat the Eagles a week from tomorrow, thereby winning their third Super Bowl in 4 years. Patriots head coach Bill Belichick has been on record for a year on the dynasty question. He doesn't want to talk about it. In September, kicker Adam Vinatieri allowed us how, quote, dynasty is a funny word. He went on to suggest that the Pats still had a lot of things to prove. This week, Pats players have remained reluctant to discuss whether they're playing for dynasty status. Tight end Jed Weaver denied that he and his teammates had even thought about it.
No, definitely not. I mean, that's for all the smart people on TV and the radio to talk about and that. And, you know, we're just concentrating on what we got to do and go out and try to make things happen and win the game.
As Jed Weaver suggests, outside observers have been more willing to label the current Patriots a potential dynasty. One of the more qualified of those observers is Phil Kuhn, a professor of Chinese history at Harvard University.
Dynasty actually is a very flexible term in the West. It comes from a Greek word meaning lordship. Since the Patriots lord it over everybody, I think that's a very appropriate designation for them.
In our conversation on Wednesday, Professor Kuhn went on to offer another comparison between dynasties off the field and on it, and a few words of caution as well.
One of the things about dynasties in China or anywhere else is that they basically try to keep going for a long time, and they do it by beating the opposition's heads in.
Now, what tends to bring dynasties down?
They overreach themselves. They try field goals from too far back in the field, and basically they get fat and lazy. They get so pleased with themselves and so complacent that some other team comes along and beats their heads in.
Something for the Patriots to consider, if they haven't already thought of it, which, given Coach Belichick's penchant for thorough preparation, seems exceptionally unlikely. If the Patriots are to achieve the status of dynasty, they would be spoken of in conjunction with exceptionally successful San Francisco, Pittsburgh, and Dallas teams of the past. Missing from that list is the Buffalo Bills, a team that went to the Super Bowl 4 consecutive times without winning it. That experience may account for the perspective former Buffalo coach Marv Levy brings to the discussion of dynasties and the Super Bowl.
Yes, it's exciting. It's sport. It's athletic competition. You can exult if you come away with a very meaningful victory. But the equating of an athletic contest with war, the best expression I ever heard of that was by a former back in the 1950s, Artie Donovan, who was a great defensive lineman with the Baltimore Colts. Artie had landed during World War II on the beaches at Normandy. And he says, I keep hearing people say football is war. He said, no, it isn't. He said, football is fun. War isn't fun. I know. I've been involved in both.
Levy, who's recently written a book about his coaching experiences entitled Where Else Would You Rather Be, is not surprisingly also reluctant to toss the label dynasty around.
People want to call them that? Go ahead. It's a free country. I'm just going to say they've been dominant over a period of years, and they deserve their accolades. But again, a dynasty, after 1,000 years have passed, we'll talk about it then.
In a sports culture in which hyperbole rules, fans, commentators, and others with less perspective won't wait that long, of course, at least if New England beats Philadelphia a week from tomorrow. The exodus of college underclassmen opting for the pros and the trend of teen phenoms skipping campus life altogether was supposed to spell doom for men's college basketball, but a recent article in Sports Illustrated indicates that television ratings have risen significantly over last years. Joining me to dispute or refute the notion that men's college basketball is enjoying a hoops renaissance is Pat Forty, who covers the college game for ESPN.com. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
Well, what do you think? Do you agree with Sports Illustrated? Is the men's game, in fact, against all predictions on the way up?
Well, I think that this has been a very good year for it, Bill. I think college basketball is enjoying at least one fine season. There are probably a couple of reasons why it is enjoying some higher ratings. One with the lack of hockey being played, and the other with the brawl in Detroit, I think, has turned off people in fairly large numbers to the NBA. So I think that there are reasons why some people are looking for another alternative, and college basketball is giving it to them. There's a lot more teams with upperclassmen who are actually playing vital parts this year, so there's maybe a little higher quality, a little more name recognition as well with some of the teams that are at the top of the heap. And it's been a great season so far. I've really enjoyed covering it.
Well, I don't know whether to say, though, that this year is a fluke or that last year was, because if it's, addition by subtraction, no hockey and bad rep for the NBA, maybe we sink again next year.
Well, that's entirely possible. I'm not sure that this is a long-term trend. I think we'll have to see kind of how it plays out. The one thing that could be positive from a long-term perspective is that, the more European players are coming into the game, the more likely perhaps the American players will be to go to college and learn the game a little bit more, because their spots in the draft are going to be taken, guys that are more prepared. So they may have to get a little more seasoning as well. We're still swimming a little bit upstream here as a whole, I think, with college basketball, because the recent dynamics of the game have been so injurious to college in favor of the pros.
Illinois is undefeated, number one team in the nation. Last year, St. Joseph's had an undefeated regular season, but they played in a relatively weak Atlantic 10 conference. Many questioned how good the Hawks really were, even though they didn't lose. Nobody could question the Illini's legitimacy if their record remains unblemished, could they?
No, absolutely not. Not only did they play a very good non-conference schedule and just thump all the ranked teams that they played, but they play in a good conference. This is not a great Big Ten. It's not a vintage Big Ten, but it's a very good league. And if they should somehow get through this undefeated, and I don't think they will, it's going to be too hard. They still have to play at Michigan State and a couple other tough games as well. But if they should somehow get through undefeated, it's one of the great regular seasons in recent history.
It's still fairly early in the season, but there is a theory that says it's better to lose sometime during the regular season than go into the tournament with an undefeated record. Or is that just a theory held by coaches who coach teams who have lost?
No, I think that there is something that seems to be restorative about a loss, restoring of perspective perhaps, and removing some of the pressure. And I just think anybody, if Illinois runs the table or Boston College runs the table in the regular season, the spotlight would be so bright on them. And these are both two programs that just aren't used to that. They're not used to, toting a number one seed, much less an undefeated ranking, into the postseason. I think they'd be better off having lost somewhere in there just to take the edge off.
Well, since you mentioned Boston College and the Big East Conference, the Eagles have surprised with their spotless record, but this can't go on much longer, can it?
Well, they've been a real revelation. You can't say enough for Al Skinner, who was an old college teammate of Rick Pitino's, and I was talking to Rick Pitino recently about him, and he said if there was one guy you would never have guessed would be a coach, it was Al. And he said that the laid-back demeanor, actually, that he has always had his whole life, apparently, works to his advantage, as it turns out, in coaching. Syracuse is very good as well. So I think the Big East, it's a great year in the Big East. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But Boston College is legit. They haven't gotten to the meat of the Big East yet. They haven't had to take on Syracuse yet. But, what they have done, you cannot knock.
Perhaps the toughest place to play is the Atlantic Coast Conference, featuring three teams currently ranked in the top five in the nation. As good as Illinois is, should we be surprised to see the national champion emerge from the ACC?
It's entirely possible to have a national champion out of the ACC this year, Bill. North Carolina has the best talent in the country, and they will, I think, be probably very prominently in the mix before all is said and done. Wake Forest is having a tremendous season. Great backcourt there. I know they lost by a point to Georgia Tech, but that's no great shame in Atlanta. Duke is having a great season. We're used to them being up there, but this would have, you thought, been one year where they may take a step back. They haven't done so. And Georgia Tech as well. They made the championship game last year. They've stumbled a little bit this season, but they have the talent. B.J. Elder has been hurt. When he comes back, they could make a Final Four run as well. So it would not be a surprise to see two or even three teams from the ACC in the Final Four.
Pat, the last time we talked, you thought Creighton University might be the latest scrappy small school to emerge from obscurity and capture the national spotlight. That didn't quite work out, but we at Only a Gamer, generous and forgiving, perhaps to a fault. Anyway, here's your chance to make amends.
Creighton has let me down, daggone it. But let's look in their same conference. What about Wichita State having a great season there? And they look like the class of the Missouri Valley, which is one of those leagues that never quite gets enough attention but always ends up with one, if not two or three teams in the NCAA tournament, and then they always pull off an upset or two when they're there. So, given the chance to repair my bandwagon jumping, I'm going to go ahead and jump on Wichita State now.
All right, they won't be in the big dance this March, but one of the more remarkable stories this year, it seems to me, is the University of Redlands, a Division III school in California. The Bulldogs are averaging an astonishing 147 points a game. Have there been any Paul Westhead sightings in Redlands?
You know, it's the Paul Westhead, you know, basketball on amphetamine sort of style, that's for sure. Fascinating way they play out there. And also Grinnell College plays this way, too. And they're actually going to have a game on ESPN coming up in early February, if people want to look, where, you know, every shot's a three-pointer, every trip up and down the floor is a sprint, and they change full lines of players like hockey, basically line substitutions, five guys in, five guys out every minute and a half, 2 minutes. And it's a wild free-for-all style, but it's a lot of fun to watch. I'm not sure it's going to win Final Fours, but it seems to be a big success on the Division III level.
Pat Forde covers college basketball for ESPN.com. Pat, thanks again.
My pleasure, Bill.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Rap star Snoop Dogg revealed this week that his dream is to coach in the National Football League, quote, probably for the Steelers. Snoop's experience includes coaching his 10-year-old son Spanky's team, a responsibility that he reportedly takes very seriously. Asked whether it's true that he sends members of his posse out to videotape practices of opponents, Snoop said, quote, it's completely legal. Snoop also claims he could be an NFL wide receiver if he wanted to, but that and other boasts have lost some of their luster given the Super Bowl prediction Snoop made before the conference championship game. He said the Super Bowl would see Pittsburgh beat Atlanta 20-14.
And who's that? He is I, and I am him. Slim with the tilted brim.
What's your name, Snoop?
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce has a prediction for the Illini Hoopsters of Champaign. But first, Aline DeLongle may have been the most successful female race car driver of the first half of the 20th century. She was certainly the most notorious. That distinction is never far from the surface of Bugatti Queen, Miranda Seymour's biography of Aline DeLongle, whose professional name was Elenice. Miranda Seymour joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Lovely to be here, Bill.
Your book is subtitled In Search of a French Racing Legend. Tell me a little bit about how you discovered this particular legend and decided that uncovering her story would be an engaging project.
It's the kind of story that doesn't normally happen to biographers. It's usually quite a boring business of looking around for a good subject and then your editor or you think of something and it's all pretty straightforward. This one was not like that at all. A friend of mine who's an antique dealer came to stay with me and he had barely got through the door before he said, Miranda, I've got the most wonderful book for you to write. And I said, no, don't tell me this. I just want to have a good time. Take your idea away. And he said, no, really, look at this picture. And he's put in front of me this wonderful face, and it's actually the photograph that appears on the front of the book. Mm-hmm. And it's a laughing girl with the best smile you ever saw, just absolutely on top of the world, sitting on the torpedo tail of her Bugatti 35, as I learned. And I just was enchanted by her. And my friend said, well, the thing was that he had bought in an auction near Saint-Tropez a strange old fading book of cuttings. They were all about this wonderful girl in 1930 who had beaten the world record in a Bugatti in 1929. And the photographs showed that she'd also been a dancer, she'd been a ballet dancer, she'd been a stripper. She'd come to America. She'd taken place in 19 events over here. So I was then told by my friend that he had this one small problem, which was that he had no idea whether these cuttings had got to. He'd sold them to somebody, but he didn't know where that person was. I was off on a complete chase after nothing. I had nothing to go on at all except for this one fabulous picture. I tracked the car through the auction rooms at Christie's and found that it had been sold to an American called Oscar Davis. And Oscar had her car and the books of cuttings. And Oscar, who was wonderful, and was about, I know, somewhere over 80, I think, and drove incredibly fast out to New Jersey, obviously in the spirit of Hellish Nice, as I found she was called, because she was very available and very charming. And I looked at all the cuttings with Oscar, and it was just wonderful. And we both were going, ooh and ah, over this amazing naked lady beaming away at us. And that's where the story began.
Ellie Neese made her way into the world of auto racing in part because car manufacturers and marketers 80 years ago, like car manufacturers and marketers today, figured that associating their products with an attractive woman couldn't hurt business. How did she graduate from ornament to extremely successful driver?
Well, that again is a pretty extraordinary story. There was nothing in her own history to do with cars at all. And she came from a very poor background, which is very unusual in the racing world of that time. We're talking about the 1920s, when there were women racers taking part in Grand Prix, women racing against women. Mm-hmm. And Helen Neese had been hanging out with ex-pilots from the First World War who became racing drivers because they were very daring, they had fantastic reactions, and they had no employment after the First World War. And she very much wanted to get into that world, but I think was discouraged by the racing drivers who knew just how dangerous it was. It wasn't unusual for three or four people to be killed in a race in those days. Not unusual at all.
But she had a certain determination that could not be denied even under those circumstances.
You can say that again. I've never met such a determined woman. And with that captivating smile, she could usually get what she wanted. She became a top skier and mountaineer and dancer before she broke her knee and was told she could never dance again. Helen Neese in 1929 decided that she was going to race with all the skills she'd learnt from her racing driver friends. And to the chagrin of all her friends in the dancing and theatrical world, she left them absolutely at the starting line. And a friend of Ettore Bugatti was there and saw this devastating performance. And she did another at the women's championships later that summer. And Ettore Bugatti needed a woman to make his cars look attractive to women. He wanted, as you say, the female market.
Ellie Neese's most enduring legacy as a driver would seem to be the speed records that she set in events that may be mysterious to contemporary readers. What sort of records does she still hold, and how did those events get run?
Well, the first and most famous of her records was at the Speed Bowl called Montlhéry, which is at last very sadly being closed down, but it was the one that all the drivers in Europe would go over to near Paris to try out their speeds. And she went there with Ettore Bugatti footing the bill and providing her with a customised car because she was very tiny. Helen Neese's car, which I've driven, her Bugatti that she broke the record in, had both the gear stick and the brake outside of the car. You had to reach right outside mm-hmm. to operate those. There's a tiny little windshield. You could actually see the ground through the floor because it's just made of welded together bits of aluminium. And it's very, very hot. I was astonished when I drove her car by the heat building up, and I had burn marks on the side of my thighs. So it's not at all a comfortable experience. And that's the car in which she reached what sounds a very modest speed today. It was 200 kilometres an hour. But she maintained that speed over 10 laps. Now, that, in those days and today, is very, very impressive to keep up that speed. Do it over one lap, fine, but to keep it up over 10 laps is very impressive. And that's where she really showed her skill.
The photographs in the book, and you, of course, referred to beginning your quest with one photograph, the photographs testify to Helenice's beauty. The camera loved her, as the saying goes, and she was certainly not reluctant to pose. But she must have also been quite strong to be able to handle the car she drove over dirt tracks and rutted courses, as you say, a physical challenge.
It probably helped that she had had quite a very successful career as a dancer and also as a mountaineer and skier. And actually, there was one of the photographs, which is of her typically on a visit to Brazil in 1936, appearing in the papers as the first woman in Brazil to appear in a bikini. And there she is on the beach in her bikini. But you can, on this occasion, see just how powerful her arms are. Very, very strongly built, but also very slender and very, very appealing figure in that way. You needed incredible strength because, again, I discovered from driving her car myself that the wheel is very, very lightly balanced. There's no power steering or anything like that. And I found after driving for about half an hour, I was completely exhausted and my back and my shoulders were aching for days after that. Mm. Well, I'm quite tall and quite strong. She was tiny. I'm so impressed by her athleticism.
Part of the story of Helenice's life is the story of travel. She did, at some point, make it to America.
She did. She came over in 1930. The French press reported that she'd been doing some film tests, and it looks as though she may have hoped to make it into movies, which, of course, an awful lot of French stars were doing rather successfully at that time. But she came over with an extraordinary operation called the Hot News Agency, which was run by a man called Ralph Hankinson. And Ralph Hankinson had taken over a lot of the dirt tracks and speed bowls in America in 1930. And what he wanted was to put Helenice out there as the first woman ever racing in these incredibly dangerous events. Helenice found herself driving in what were effectively a sort of hail of boulders coming round her because the clay just flew up off the track. Mm. And she was told not to wear a helmet because the crowd would want to see her hair. And I think one of the most representative stories of her guts is when she was doing this at Winston-Salem and her miller that she was driving that day turned over and the crowd thought she'd been killed. And she crawled out from under the car, ran back down the track towards the grandstand, waving her white beret in the air, put her hands on her hips and sang the crowd a song. And that is so typical of her. She just was always there with an almost super sensitive sense of what the crowd would want, and that was what she would respond to.
By the time the Second World War began, Helenice's career as a driver was essentially over. She would race a couple more times, but some of the most fascinating material in the book involves your description of the ways in which the French survived during the days of the Nazi occupation. How much were you able to learn about Helenice's particular sympathies and strategies during those days?
Very little indeed, which tells you a great deal about the trauma that the French still have with the years of the occupation. It does interest me that although Bugatti Queen's now been translated, well, it's being translated into 8 different languages, the French have steadfastly refused to touch it, although she is a great French star. I think this has a lot to do with the fact that it does deal with a woman who was living in Paris and then in Nice during the Second World War and was accused by a driver called Louis Chiron of having been a Gestapo agent. Mm. And poor Helenice was never given a chance to defend herself at all. All of her engagements were cancelled. She was saved by an old charity for dancers, curiously enough, and they were the ones who looked after her till her death. It may be that even the family believed that terrible charge, because when I found where she'd been buried, I found to my horror that her name wasn't even there on the family gravestone.
It's as if she had disgraced the name and been erased altogether.
As if. And in the end, I had to go to Germany, strangely enough, to find out the truth. After months and months of fruitless attempts in France to get anywhere, and people would put telephones down on me, they wouldn't answer my emails, they wouldn't answer my letters, I was really quite desperate. And I went to Germany, and I had this wonderfully jolly response immediately in Potsdam, where they said, oh, of course, we must find out this poor woman, it's probably a false charge. And it was. She had never been a Gestapo agent. And Louis Chiron had simply made it up. And it's really so sad, because she was the great woman racer of her time. Everybody agrees on that. And her name has been destroyed.
Hélénice died in 1984. She was 83 years old. And you write at the end of your book, quote, "She deserves to be honored and recalled as she was once described, as a champion of the world." Have historians of auto racing at least regarded her that way?
Well, not until now, which sounds terribly egotistic of me, but the thing is that Louis Chiron's job that he did in destroying her name was so thorough that even the most knowledgeable and authoritative of the automotive historians don't seem really to have been able to get past the fact that they had a sense that she might have been working for the Gestapo. And so in the books that I read which mention her, a lot of them didn't mention her at all, which is rather puzzling. There's always kind of a faint taint. And I was very baffled by this, because you just get a kind of whiff of they're not really wanting to say too much about her. And it does seem now, from the response I've had, I've given a lot of talks to automobile associations, and they're so enthusiastic about her that I really feel sure that her reputation is now going to recover.
Miranda Seymour is the author of Bugatti Queen, In Search of a French Racing Legend, published by Random House. She joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Miranda, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, I've enjoyed this so much, Bill. It's been lovely.
You're listening to Only a Game. If the NHL lockout, now in its 135th day, has been tough on hockey fans, it's been even tougher on the players. Sure, the Joe Thorntons, the Brett Hulls, and the rest of the league's superstars are tolerating the hiatus well enough, but what about the players who had not yet begun to make the big money when the lights went out in rinks from Montreal to San Jose? Fellows like Serge Lemaire, who was obliged to sign on as a bouncer at the notorious Cracked Head Club on Chicago's South Side.
I'm sorry, sir. I have to ask you to leave.
You ain't so big when you're not on your skates, are you?
I am on my skates.
Oh, geez. I guess it's a good thing you don't have your stick, too.
I have my stick. And you, sir, I have to ask you to leave also.
Yep, I'm gone.
What a falling off was there for Serge Lemaire. Still, at least he has the opportunity to exercise some of his hockey skills while he's at work at the Cracked Head Club. That would seem to put him a notch above Yevgeny Korsakov and Bobby Muckup, who found work with
Sesame Street on Ice. Ho, 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 there goes Little Grover.
I am the Little Grover.
Then he's got the dancing bug, boys and girls. Dancing, right into Cookie Monster's big pile of cookies.
Get, Anna, my cookies.
I am the Little Grover.
How would you like a mouthful of fists, Little Grover?
Oh, ho, ho, Cookie Monster's dropped his gloves, boys and girls, and he's taking off his head. He's got Little Grover against the boards, and... Boys and girls, it's time for me to remind you that our concession stands are open. There you can find cotton candy, soda, and a Sesame Street on Ice full-color program. And we have chocolate Elmos.
Daddy, Grover doesn't have any tea.
He's a hockey player, son.
He's not Little Grover.
Oh, the humanity!
Happily, not all the players idled by the lockout have had to resort to violence. Sven Olderborgensongen, for example, has found work as a surgeon's assistant.
Scalpel doctor?
No scalpel. Just give me the stick. And don't call me doctor.
But doctor...
I said...
Sorry, but a...
I've taken out lots of spleens with a stick, you betcha. And without benefit of any namby-pamby anesthetic, too.
But are you sure it's...
Sharp for ya.
Clean?
Oh. Gotcha there, you little spleen. Somebody get a trainer. You stitch him up.
Mr. Oldborgen standing... Mr. Oldersteinenbrenner... Mr. Utter Gotter Stoping... Would someone get a doctor to ER stat?
Maybe until now you didn't care whether the National Hockey League was in action, and maybe now you will care, especially if you're scheduled for surgery. Whoa!
Career opportunities are ones that never know.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, cyclocross fanatics Chris Cross Flagstaff, but first, Charlie Pierce joins me to discuss the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Let's talk about the number one men's basketball team in the land, Illinois. On Tuesday, they extended their winning streak to 20 games, currently the longest streak in the nation. Can the Gophers take them down this afternoon, or do we go to 21-game winning streak?
Well, my predictive powers in the Big Ten were so terrific with the Iowa Hawkeyes and LSU in that bowl game, I'm a little reluctant to bring them out of the garage again, but... I think Illinois will beat Minnesota. I think the only game that they should have a problem with in their league is the trip they have to make to Michigan State. This is a veteran team. They're very good. They hung in there. Wisconsin had them beat and then made just enough of mistakes, including missing two layups in the last 4 minutes. And Illinois was able to stretch it out and beat them by 10. I think that I've thought since the beginning of the year they were the best team in the country.
On Thursday night, the 25th-ranked Temple Owls of the female persuasion defeated Atlantic 10 rival George Washington despite a 9-minute scoring drought. Was this just a rehearsal for when the Owls meet LSU or Stanford in late in the tourney?
Well, it's always good to be able to overcome scoring droughts, but this was seven shots in 10 minutes and 11 turnovers in 10 minutes, which is more than 1 minute. The Owls still managed to be 3 points up at halftime. The remarkable thing about women's basketball this year, Bill, is I'm looking at this week's rankings, and LSU is the number one team in the country, as you mentioned. I have to go all the way to number 6 to find Tennessee, and I have to go all the way to number 10 to find Connecticut, and they've moved up. What in the hell is going on here?
A good question and an intriguing season. In a scene eerily reminiscent of last week's NHL meetings, representatives of the league and the union met for many hours on Thursday and then declared that the two sides were still too far apart philosophically to continue. Does either side stand to gain anything by not declaring the obvious, i.e., the season is dead?
Don't you get the feeling they should lock these guys in that hotel Jack Nicholson ran in The Shining? Red Drum! Red Drum! Ah! Look, it has not yet dawned on either side that no one cares. They can lose the whole thing. Now they're talking about having a 20-game season or a 30-game season. I'll tell you what. Let's have a one-game round robin. Everybody plays everybody else. Who's ever ahead at the end gets the Stanley Cup.
Well, it's
if Tampa
that...
will give it back. And if I were Tampa, I might refuse to give it back on that basis.
I do have to mention that we've gotten some emails, many emails actually, from people who do care a great deal that there is no NHL season. And what can we say except that the college hockey season is in full swing and it's great fun.
And you can, and it's cheap and you can go see it. But I mean, I know that we live... And we do this show from one of the two or three real hockey hotbeds in the lower 48. But the fact is, in a nationwide sense, people have not missed the NHL at all.
Charlie, we've dabbled in semi-important sports stories so far, but let's move on to the really meaty stuff. Will Philadelphia Eagles receiver Terrell Owens play in Super Bowl XXXIX?
I don't know, but we're going to hear 9 days' worth of speculation concerning his ankle. He can probably run, he can probably cut, he can probably catch passes. The question is, does he want to get hit on the ankle again, or does he want to have his body turned backwards over the ankle again, or does he want to see the pin that's in his ankle pop up and spring before his eyes? I think he will probably not play, but then I'll change my mind 8 or 9 times between now and the game.
New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady will certainly play unless litigation keeps him from Jacksonville. On Monday, he filed a lawsuit against General Motors for allegedly using his likeness in a Super Bowl ad after his contract with General Motors had expired. If Brady does make it to the big game, do you think he'll be able to concentrate?
I think he's probably letting his lawyers handle this one. It's really interesting because he's talking about 29 days. This ad that appeared 29 days after his contract with GM expired last January. It seems to me he has a sort of open and shut case. The problem, of course, is that if he does win his third Super Bowl MVP, he's going to have to show up in the morning after the game to a news conference where they're going to give him a nice Cadillac car made by GM. Maybe he'll wear a bag over his head.
Now, a beloved staple of the Super Bowl is going away this time, and I'm sorry. I'm too upset to break the news. Perhaps you'd do it.
No one's going to Disney World! Yes, there will not be any shouting, I'm going to Disney World this year. Somehow Disney has connected this to last year's falderall over Janet Jackson's dress. I don't know what that has to do with anything. The NFL doesn't seem to care. But I think somebody should just shout it anyway and dare them not to bring them.
Maybe they should all join hands at the end and shout it.
I'm going to Bob's Barbecue!
They'd have a better time. Anyway, former Oakland Raiders tight end Marcus Williams is suing former Raiders teammate Bill Romanowski for what Williams calls an episode of, quote, roid rage, after Romo allegedly punched him in the 2003 training camp. Should Williams prevail, will we see every NFL player suing every other NFL player?
Well, this involves roid rage. It also, appears to involve assault with intent to murder. Romanowski ripped off his helmet. He punched him in the face. He broke his orbital bones, damaged his nose, chipped a tooth. He's had problems with his eye. His career is over. Bill Romanowski's been a blight in the league for an awful long time, and if the discovery process embarrasses him publicly, that's a good thing.
Journeyman head coach George Karl has landed in Denver. His employers hope that he can refine the talented but young Nuggets. Given his experience with the talented but young U.S. national team in 2002, was this a wise hire?
This is an absolutely reflexive, boring, old-school hire. George Karl will go there. He'll have an initial run of success. The Denver will then fail. His players will hate him, and then he will leave with a losing record, and it will never be his fault.
Meanwhile, Que Calor in El Stovo. The Florida Marlins convinced free agent slugger Carlos Delgado to join that team. Don't the Red Sox, Mets, Yankees, Braves, and Dodgers have any money left?
I don't know what happened there. He wanted to go play for a contender, and now the Marlins may be one. This is a weird thing the Marlins do. Have you noticed? They win the World Series, then they stink for a few years, then they come back and win the World Series again.
Yeah, and they get sold a couple of times.
And they get sold three or four times.
Right.
I mean, it's really kind of bad because I would have liked to have seen Omar Minaya at the Mets complete the slam, but he did pretty well for himself.
Well, the Mets did land former Red Sox first baseman Doug Mankiewicz via trade. Will a famous World Series ball travel with him as well, or does that stay in the safe deposit box where the Red Sox can't get it ever?
No, he's going to loan it to him for a year. It's going to be on display. I'm sure it'll be passed from hand to hand and rubbed, and people will see the images of their late grandfather's face in it. But hopefully Mankiewicz will get it back and put it on eBay and sell it to some sucker for a lot of money.
The Lincoln, Rhode Island School District has decided to can this year's spelling bee because it violates the so-called No Child Left Behind Act. Charlie, how do you spell Armstrong Williams?
P-A-Y-O-F-F. Armstrong Williams.
Finally, Las Vegas has a new city council member, and her name is Lois Tarkanian, wife of former UNLV head basketball coach Jerry Tarkanian. What direction would you like to go with this?
Well, actually, it's interesting. The woman she's replacing, who happens to be a woman named Janet Moncrief, probably not related to Milwaukee great Sidney Moncrief, had trouble in the election because she's under investigation for campaign finance. So a Tarkanian was the reform candidate in this race, only in Vegas.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and all bets are off when he joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Red Rock!
Late last week, the U.S. Soccer Federation announced that the U.S. Men's National Team Players Association had accepted a no-strike, no-lockout provision through the end of 2005. This agreement cleared the way for the U.S. players to report to Bruce Arena's camp, where they, rather than the replacement players, are currently getting ready to play Trinidad and Tobago in a CONCACAF World Cup qualifying match on February 9th. On Thursday in Frankfurt, Germany, soccer referee Robert Heuser admitted that last summer he fixed matches upon which he had also bet. Having previously denied those allegations, Heuser acknowledged that he had rigged last August's match between Hamburg and Paderborn by ejecting Hamburg's striker from the game and by awarding two penalties to Paderborn, which eventually upset Hamburg 4-2. FIFA President Sepp Blatter expressed shock at the situation, and he has written to the German Football Association to stress the need for Heuser's case to be resolved, since the World Cup tournament is set for Germany in 2006. Why those running the Brazilian boys team in Paraná decided to put videos of its star player, 9-year-old Giancarlo Scherra, on the internet remains mysterious, but the result of their decision is that teams from Portugal, France, Germany, and the UK have contacted the club to obtain more information about young Giancarlo. In the videos, he is seen scoring goals and dribbling past defenders who are 4 and 5 years older. Some of the club teams interested in the 9-year-old boy have invited him and his family to Europe. In a further update regarding what National Hockey League players have been doing while they're not playing hockey, Peter Worrell has apparently been driving around the Fort Lauderdale area in an SUV owned by his former Florida Panthers teammate, Andreas Lilja. When he was stopped because the vehicle had an expired tag, Worrell claimed that he was, in fact, Andreas Lilja, although he is 4 inches taller than the owner of the SUV. Worrell is also black, whereas Andreas Lilja, like almost all the other Swedes playing hockey in Sweden this winter, is white. Finally, in an event that threatens to set back women's sports to pre-Title IX levels, ex-figure skater Tanya Harding knocked out pro wrestler Brittany Drake in round one of their Florida bout this week. There's no particular reason to mention that, I suppose, except that with regard to her past, which includes conspiring to whack rival figure skater Nancy Kerrigan in the knee, Harding provided some useful advice. "Everyone makes mistakes," she said. "You just have to learn from them and move on." Cyclocross combines the speed of elite bicycle road racing with the danger of mountain biking. This weekend in Germany, the world's top cyclocross racers are gathered for the World Championships. Arizona Public Radio's Sadie Babbitts recently went to the sparsely attended Arizona State Championships, and she produced this cyclocross sound portrait. The race began on Northern Arizona University's Skydome football field.
So if you're a master racer, please make your way to the start finish line for final race instructions. You're going to have a 30-minute race.
Got it. When do you come back?
In a bunny hop.
First aid will be located at registration if you guys need it. A guy named Mike. Feed zone in the pit is right here. On the numbers between the goal line and the 30-yard line. When you exit the dome, that is the sketchiest part. There's ice under the snow. I'm sure you've pre-ridden it. Just adjust your speed accordingly. You guys have any questions?
This race will be 30 minutes, and we will start at Jeff Dillon's request.
Riders, take your marks. Ready, go!
The guru putting the hammer down, followed closely by two Red Rock racers.
Come on, man.
My name is Eric Neat. By day, I'm a mild-mannered school teacher. When I'm not doing that, I fight crime in my spandex with my bicycle. The course, it zigzags as much as it can on the NAU field in there, and then it comes out, and yeah, it kind of does a figure eight to the snow here. And it's really slippery and really snowy, and people are having a hard time pedaling up the hills, and they're having a hard time sliding down the hills, and they look like they're really cold.
Go, Brian!
Come on, Brian. Paddle, 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 paddle. Spin it up, this thing. You know, it's on a course like this, you get no recovery. So you're out here pedaling in the snow, and that's really hard to do. And then you get inside the dome here, and the football field is really soft, so it feels like you're pedaling through really thick mud. So the whole course is just hard. No recovery. Some of these guys are on mountain bikes, where it's a little bit easier riding this stuff on a mountain bike. I think it's a little cooler to be doing it on a cross bike. It's a little squirrelier. You're in your drop bars. You're on your skinny tires. More possibility of a crash. If you can keep that up, I think that's that's saying a little more than trying to keep your mountain bike up. Although if I was doing this, I'd be on my mountain bike.
Yeah. Stay together. Stay together.
I'm Jackie Dank. I work for the Forest Service out of Williams, Arizona.
Just over 10 minutes to go. Just over 10 minutes to go for the Masters race.
I've never seen cyclocross before, and I am impressed. It looks like a lot of hard work. I can't get over how many times they go around, and they're jumping over these obstacles, and they're going outside, and there's a ton of snow out there. We were standing outside, and an avalanche almost fell on us from the gymnasium. It's a pretty intense race.
My name is Gabriel Joseph Keck. I've crashed into the barriers, I've crashed in the corners, I've crashed on asphalt, I've crashed in snow. I crash a lot. So that's definitely part of the cyclocross. You got to jump up and just keep on getting it.
Coming around the corner here is John Sawoski going out for one lap to go. One lap to go. This is the bell lap for John Sawoski.
Do I like doing it? It's good for the soul. It's good for the character. Suffering is good.
In the lead, one more turn to go. One more turn to go. In the Masters 30-plus race, into the final stretch. With the lead, John Sawoski, Red Rock Racers. Put your hands together.
Hi, my name is John Sawoski. I'm 34 years old. I'm a teacher in Flagstaff, Arizona, and I'm not riding my bike.
Coming into his final turn. Right?
Getting up this morning, I had no idea I'd even be in the top three, but you know, I looked outside and I saw there were about 5-6 inches of snow. I thought, you know, this is something I got to do. You know, these are one of those races you'll tell your kids about and everybody at work. And you know, years ago, you go, yeah, remember that race when it was just totally sketchy? Yeah, so there was no doubt in my mind that I was going to race.
Third place, Brian Antal, Red Rock Racers. Here comes Gabe Keck in fourth place, Red Rock Racers.
Put it down.
Good job, John.
Counter spinner.
Jump up and get down.
Have racers on the course, those who are warming up, please be aware of that. We've got about 15 minutes to go before the start of the men's A race. 15 minutes, that'll start at 11:30. Make sure you've pre-ridden the course.
The team dubbed Red Rock Racers dominated Arizona's cyclocross championships along with the Flagstaff-based team Flag Velo. This weekend, the top cyclocross racers gather in Germany for the world championships. Our sound portrait was produced by Arizona Public Radio's Sadie Babbitts. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Special thanks to the Only a Game players Sean Cole, John Marston, Matt Odette, Jen Savio, Anna Benstead, and Kelvin Mr. Haiku Brooks. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Bugatti Queen, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Bugatti Queen author Miranda Seymour, who wonders in retrospect whether her French pronunciation should have spilled over into her English.
Shall I say chagrin? Shall I say chagrin?
I'm not sure I'm quite the right person to ask about that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. We'll be right back. This is NPR, National Public Radio.